Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are wrestling with a subject that really touches on institutional power, public trust, and where the buck stops when a system fails.
Good big one.
It is. Our deep dive is all about the New York City Police Department's very public, very aggressive crackdown on what they're calling overtime abuse.
It's a fascinating and I think really complex analysis of institutional self-preservation, of political messaging.
Right.
And our sources, they lay out the legal and political dynamics here, and our mission really is to figure out whether this whole push for reform is genuine structural change.
Or something else entirely, a sophisticated political maneuver maybe just designed to protect leadership from, you know, taking the heat.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's unpack this. We have to start with the foundational concept the sources all point to, which is selective outrage.
Right, selective outrage. This is the strategic move that public institutions make when a system they've tolerated for a long, long time.
A system they relied on?
Relied on, exactly. When that system suddenly becomes politically inconvenient, it worked one way for years, everybody was fine with it, but then the political winds shift.
And when those winds shift, the whole maneuver begins. It's basically an effort to, what, wash their hands of systemic failure by blaming people lower down the chain.
That's it. You redirect all the accountability away from the expensive, really complex systemic problems, and you point it right at the most expendable rank-and-file actors.
They refuse to confront the very architecture they designed, that they funded, and that they, as you said, relied on for years.
Precisely. And this move, it has a very specific consequence. Because when that selective outrage hardens, when it turns into actual punishment.
Careers damaged, sanctions, people being denied credentials.
Yes. When that happens, it gets a second and legally a much more dangerous name.
And that name is retaliation.
Right. And the sources are absolutely crystal clear on this. There's a through line here. Institutions cannot profit from systems they designed and then just retroactively disown them with some kind of manufactured moral outrage when politics change.
That just doesn't hold up, legally or logically.
It doesn't.
So our mission today is to unpack the legal foundation that exists to stop exactly this kind of move. The legal idea that liability flows upward, not downward.
That's the core of it.
All right, so let's start with the political context. The NYPD has made a huge public show of this, targeting overtime abuse. And for the average listener, you know, the taxpayer, this sounds great. It sounds like a long overdue cleanup.
Of course it does.
So what is this fixation really about? Is it some belated discovery of deep corruption that leadership was just blind to for decades?
Well, according to the analysis we have, the timing is, let's say, a little too perfect for that. The sources conclude this is really born of institutional panic and maybe more importantly, political theater. It's all carefully staged, especially under the current administration, for what they call optical redemption.
Optical redemption. That's a powerful phrase. What does that actually look like on the ground?
Well, it looks like, you know, a big press conference announcing actions against specific, usually lower level, very visible units.
Well, what?
While quietly giving immunity to, or just ignoring, the exact same systemic processes in more favored, high-ranking units. The department needs a clean slate, a reputational reset.
And to announce that you're the savior of integrity, you first need a sinful past.
You need a sin. And the overtime narrative supplies that sin perfectly. And it does it without forcing them to admit their own structural design failure.
So the key thing for you listening is to stop thinking of overtime as just, I don't know, a moral lapse or an individual vice. You have to see it for what it is in this context.
It's a systemic output. This isn't just an anomaly that some inattentive leader tolerated. This was an indispensable mechanism, and it was produced by very specific institutional design choices.
Okay, so choices like what?
Think about it this way. The NYPD is chronically understaffed. We all know this. But at the same time, the political demands for cops on the street are expanding.
Right, more presence on subways, more officers at protests, responding to every new public safety concern.
They have to project control, but they don't have the budget or the people to actually fund that control.
So overtime becomes the bridge.
It's the mandatory bridge. They relied on it for years to fill that gap between what was demanded of them and what their capacity actually was. Commanders approved it. Budget offices planned for it. Payroll processed it. It was routine.
The conduct didn't change.
The political narrative did. The system did what it had to do to deal with the political pressure, and now that very mechanism is being weaponized.
Okay, but wait, let me push back a little on that. I mean, speaking as a skeptical taxpayer, surely some of this is actual abuse, right? If an officer is clocking 20 hours when they were only on duty for 10, that's just fraud. It's criminal. So how does the law distinguish between a systemic output and outright criminal fraud?
That's a critical distinction. And the law absolutely accounts for outright fraud, no question.
Yeah.
But the focus here is on that huge gray area.
Okay.
The conduct that was once approved, that was maybe vaguely defined, and was performed in good faith to meet a mandate.
Yeah.
You know, the sloppy paperwork, the quick approvals, the long hours that a supervisor signed off on because the need was there.
And selective outrage is designed to treat that gray area as if it were clear-cut black and white fraud.
Exactly. It eliminates the need to prove criminal intent.
And this leads us to what I think is the most disturbing part. The asymmetry of enforcement. This outrage seems to track power, race, and gender.
That is the most damning part of this analysis. For years, when these overtime systems disproportionately benefited, say, white male officers in politically favored units.
Specialized task forces, that sort of thing.
Exactly. The response was accommodation, silence. They normalized it. Rules were bent, budgets were justified.
What?
But when those exact same structural systems, the need for coverage, the pressure to meet mandates, when they appear to benefit black officers, Latino officers, or women, the whole tone shifts instantly.
Accommodation becomes hyper-suspicion.
And immediate investigation. Structural necessity gets rebranded as individual moral failure and condemnation.
And that asymmetry, it preserves the hierarchy while claiming to be neutral. It's brilliant in a way.
It allows leadership to say they're restoring integrity by cracking down while they're quietly reinforcing who is presumed to be legitimate inside the department and who is perpetually suspect. They collapse their own systemic failures into your individual moral failure.
Which brings us directly to the law. Can institutions actually pull this off? Can they design a flawed system, rely on it, and then disown the people who just complied with it?
Well, the courts are very clear that they cannot. The foundational principle here is found in a case, Becker v. City of New York. In this case, it basically stands for the principle that institutions cannot just evade responsibility for a systemic long-standing failure by scapegoating the employees who are acting within the structures management created.
So if I understand Becker correctly, it's like a CEO knowing their factory floor is dangerously understaffed, telling managers to cut corners to hit targets, and then when a worker gets hurt, blaming the manager for the unsafe conditions.
That's an excellent analogy. The conclusion in Becker is the key. When conduct happens inside a known institutional system, no matter how flawed or imperfect liability flows upward.
It does not flow downward.
It does not flow downward to the person just trying to keep the wheels on.
So that forecloses the idea that a new administration gets to reset the clock. They can't just say, well, the old boss tolerated it, but we're the new boss, so we get to retroactively punish everyone who followed the old rules.
Correct. Institutional memory cannot be selectively erased just to manufacture the appearance of reform. If the city benefited from the work, the conduct was institutional. End of story.
Now, institutions always have a backup plan. So the next legal escape hatch they try is the rogue employee narrative.
Yes, the rogue employee.
Right. Okay, fine. The system was flawed. But this particular officer acted solely for personal gain. They abandoned the department's interests. Can they successfully claim that?
That defense is a legal Hail Mary. It is extremely difficult to prove because the standard is just so high.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have to look at Center v. Hampton Affiliates. In that case, the Court of Appeals sharply narrowed this whole adverse interest exception. It only applies if the employee totally abandoned the employer's interests.
Totally abandoned. That's a huge bar to clear.
It is. If the employer got any partial benefit from the action, even if the employee also benefited, the defense just collapses.
Give us an example of that.
So think back to our patrol car. If the officer drove it two blocks out of their way for a personal errand, but they were still covering their sector, still answering the radio.
The department still benefited. The car was staffed. It was present.
That single benefit destroys the defense.
And why is that narrow standard so fatal to the NYPD's overtime narrative?
Because the NYPD demonstrably benefited from the work. The overtime insured sectors were covered. It satisfied those high-profile political demands for subway patrols. It kept critical units staffed. It ultimately preserved the jobs and reputations of leadership.
So conduct that sustains the institution can't be rebranded as total personal deviance.
It proves institutional dependence, not opposition.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, moving on from the rogue employee theory, let's talk about the data problem. The NYPD's narrative relies on saying the records are faulty and that these faulty records are evidence of a divorce.
Right.
But what happens legally when the institution is the one that controls the timekeeping and the supervision?
This is a classic area of liability. And federal wage and hour law is incredibly clear here. We look at Anderson v. N. Clements Pottery Co. The court established that the employer controls the timekeeping, the records, all the supervision. So if the system is defective or messy or it creates uncertainty about the exact hours worked, that legal risk cuts against the employer.
Not the worker.
Not the worker.
So an agency can't build an overtime-dependent system, demand its use for years, and then suddenly declare the outputs are abuse just because the documentation they controlled is now deemed embarrassing.
That conclusion is unavoidable. Record-keeping failures are governance failures. And a governance failure does not become a justification for blaming or punishing the worker.
And trying to turn the outputs of management's own broken system into some kind of individualized sin is exactly what the law rejects.
It is, and New York law echoes this. Our sources cite Matter of Mid-Hudson Pam Corr v. Hartnett, which specifically rejected employer narratives that tried to recharacterize their own structural failures as individual wrongdoing.
This brings us back to that term you used earlier, institutional gaslighting.
That's what it is. It's the process where management claims the inevitable sloppy outputs of its own bad system are actually evidence of an employee's moral failure.
And then they sell the subsequent discipline as legitimate reform.
And Mid-Hudson Pam rejects that kind of manipulative storytelling, especially when an employee's resistance to that false story is what triggers the retaliation.
Hmm. Okay, so we've established the legal frameworks reject the rhetoric here. Now we move from rhetoric to actual consequences. This is where selective outrage hardens into real retaliation.
Yes, because leadership, they want to avoid the visibility and the due process that comes with an outright termination.
Sure.
So they rely on far more subtle mechanisms, what our sources call paper-based sanctions or credential weaponization. They use administrative levers to punish without the visibility of a big disciplinary hearing.
This is so critical because institutions will just dismiss these paper decisions. Oh, it's trivial. It's just administrative. But the case of Paros v. County of Nassau exposes what these decisions really are.
Exactly. Paros is huge. The Eastern District of New York confronted the systematic withholding of good guy letters, which are these discretionary recommendations, from disabled retirees.
And the court found that denying those letters, it functioned as punishment. Even though it wasn't an official disciplinary action.
It was absolutely punishment.
What were the specific material consequences the court found that proved this?
There were three key things. First, humiliation and stigma. The denial acts as a scarlet letter in professional circles.
Okay.
Second, and this is crucial, it caused massive reputational injury and harm to their employability, especially in the security sector, where these letters are essential to find work. And third, they even identified safety risks.
Safety risks? How so?
Well, a lack of proper official documentation can seriously impact an individual's identity and their future encounters with law enforcement.
Wow, that's a powerful observation, that an administrative decision can function as discipline and cause such concrete damage.
And the court awarded compensatory and punitive damages. It confirmed that these paper decisions are not neutral. They're disciplined by other less visible means.
It's a clear message. You can't just dismiss the impact of paperwork when it's being used to punish or enforce a political narrative.
It carries real legal weight.
So if this kind of credential interference, this paper punishment, if it's widespread and it follows leadership's messaging and disproportionately affects certain groups, how does that implicate the entire city?
That's where we bring in the doctrine of Monell v. Department of Social Services.
Mm.
Monell is the key legal framework for municipal liability.
Right.
It basically says a city isn't liable for one rogue employee, but it is liable if the harm results from an official policy or, and this is key, an unofficial but well-settled custom or practice.
So if the mayor or the police commissioner goes on TV and announces a crackdown on overtime abuse, and then a pattern of this paper-based retaliation against a certain group of employees immediately follows that.
It starts to look less like an isolated mistake and more like an official custom.
And the city owns that custom.
Precisely. If those administrative tools are being used to enforce loyalty or punish dissent or just manage optics in line with the leadership's narrative, liability flows straight up to the city itself.
And finally, we're starting to see some judicial skepticism toward this entire process. This idea that a crackdown automatically equals progress.
That skepticism is the signal from recent cases, like Chislett. courts are less and less willing to just accept the premise that retroactive discipline is progress.
Especially when it's untethered from the rules that were tolerated for years and it's only enforced against certain people.
Exactly. When a department's reform starts to look less like genuine accountability and more like pure optics-driven retaliation, the judiciary is starting to question the entire good faith premise of it.
So this whole deep dive really reveals the institutional trick that the law rejects. Selective outrage is just institutional self-preservation math grading as integrity.
That's it.
Leadership gets a pass, the architecture of the system is untouched, and accountability is conveniently pushed downward onto individuals who are just complying with yesterday's rules.
And the legal through line is so consistent across all these cases we talked about. Becker, Center, Anderson, Perros. Institutions cannot use retroactive moral condemnation to rewrite history and escape liability for the systems they themselves designed and benefited from.
You can't launder systemic dependence through individualized blame.
You can't.
The question is not whether the NYPD needs reform. It absolutely does. I mean, every major public institution does. We all know that.
But the deeper question is whether that reform will be structural. You know, based on honesty about staffing levels, budget realities, command accountability, or if the department will just continue to practice selective outrage.
Punishing compliance with yesterday's flawed rules to protect the architects of those rules today.
Exactly.
And that leaves you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over.
The law demands reform without institutional amnesia. When the performance of reform depends entirely on erasing history and punishing a convenient past, it stops being progress. It immediately becomes a litigation risk.
So what does it cost an institution?
What does it cost an institution, legally and culturally? When the effort to look like you're reforming becomes the primary evidence used against you in a retaliation lawsuit, that is the real consequence of selective outrage.